Hey everybody, welcome to Required Reading. This week we are talking about The Bourne Identity. Now, I know we had talked about doing some more stuff during the summer, and I hope you enjoyed the short story, A Wrong Cruelly Done, written by one of my co-hosts. In the meantime, there will be more short stories coming up, but for now, we're going to do what we do, which is, talk books. This week we are talking the kind of classic 1980 Robert Ludlum espionage thriller, The Bourne Identity. And coming up next after this, we will be doing World War Z. Thanks for doing all you do. Please continue to share us and like our posts and refer us to people who also read. Appreciate you. Thanks.
All right. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Required Reading. This week, we challenge whether or not Jane Eyre will be the longest book we read. I'm your host, Nick Hoffman, and on panel we have...
Mike Carroll.
Mike Burns.
And we are talking Robert Ludlum's 1980s Cold War thriller classic, The Bourne Identity, the first in what is a trilogy of his books. And then I think since he's passed, they've come out with a few additional ones. We thought this would be a good kind of summer movie because, of course, it was made into the Paul Greengrass kind of classic Matt Damon action movies, which take a post 9/11 turn towards a lot grimmer, a lot darker. This is a pretty dark, intense book, but still has some of that 80s cheese, chasing a kind of mythicized version of Carlos the Jackal, which at the time was inspiring a lot of fiction, in fact. This is the first time I had read it, but we read it at the kind of urgency, the insistence of Mike Carroll. So, yeah. Mike, why do you think this would be a good suggestion for us?
Yeah, so when we were kind of coming together and coming up with our lists of books and books that had been made into movies that we might want to cover over the course of this season, I had remembered reading The Bourne Identity, and I remembered and I'm sure I'll get into this as we make our way through the podcast, but I remembered seeing the movie first and then reading the book afterwards. And it's one of the few times that I can remember vividly reading the book after the movie. And for me, I remember reading the book. It was, I must have been like 12 or 13 years old or so. And I loved The Bourne Identity. I think for a while I called it my favorite movie. And then I wanted to read the book. I was an avid reader when I was younger as well. And I wanted to make my way through the book. And I remember getting about like a third of the way through and thinking to myself, well, this is very different from the movie. This doesn't follow the same plot that the movie followed at all. So I wanted to take a look at the book that I loved when I had finished reading it, alongside a movie that I loved, even though they're so different from one another. Because I mean, the plot is totally different from the book. So I wanted to kind of be able to take a look at what it is that I loved about the movie, what it is that I loved about the book, and get your insights in it as well, guys. So thanks for following along with what ended up being a much longer read than I remembered it being. I did not remember it being over 600 pages, and I do think that it was the version of it that I was reading was over 600 pages. So it was longer than I remembered, but I made it through it the first time, made it through it again. And I'm excited to hear what you guys think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, I'll just say overall, I liked it. But it was slow going in that, as we were talking before, in that the idea that like you are discovering is born, so it's sort of frustrating as he's trying to figure out his identity and you're trying to figure out what's going on and plot and who all these people are, and so it's sort of unfolding that way. And it's long. There was a point like a quarter of the way through, like, I don't know if I'm going to finish this. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't have the courage to text you guys and say I might be out on this one. But eventually just sort of the drama of it and the sort of whodunit, and you want to find out how it ends or how it resolves, carries you along. But I will say, like, there are a few points early on. Like, there's a point, there's a quote, it's on page 8. Oh, it's just like really, very early. It's like, oh man, what am we in for here? And it's and just this prose kind of threw me off. And this is in the middle, like he's hanging off the boat and having this flashback. There was nothing he could grab, so he grabbed at nothing. Yeah. Like, come on, man. I mean, that's just like, and there's some sentences that are real groaners like that throughout. But overall, like I said, if you want just plot based and it makes a perfect action film,
yeah.
Again, so the novel is written in 1980 and the way they adapted it is great. And the way it sort of depicts the 80s and sort of spy thrillers. Yeah, it's a fun summer read, no doubt about it. And we can talk about Marie later, but yeah. Overall, I give it a thumbs up. Yeah.
Well, and it just, and you kind of hit the nail on the head there. Like, this is late Cold War stuff, and, you know, the Bond movies had already been out for years, so, like, we have to raise the stakes. And is there anything more 80s made for TV than Retrograde Amnesia? Like,
right.
Like, yeah. Who am I, and why am I so good at killing people? Yeah. It's really just fantastic. And he has kind of carried along like that. He's like, well, how did I know how to do that? I guess I must have been a killer. Great.
Yeah.
What wonderful motivation. I will say, though, it's like, other than, you know, the basic plot synopsis, it's interesting character development. I haven't heard that kind of thing very often. And it does lead to, I can understand why they wanted to adapt this into a movie of some sort, because it does have some really interesting scenes. I'm actually surprised it took as long as it did.
Well, I was looking. I didn't know, and I was just reading this morning that it was a made-for-TV movie in 1988 with Richard Chamberlain.
Oh, there you go.
And so, I mean, that must have been around when I was in high school, but I don't remember it. So clearly, it didn't make a cultural impact like the Bourne movies in the 2000s did.
Kids at home who are listening, made for TV movies used to really be an important thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Now they're the kind of thing that are dumped on Netflix and they star almost stars,
right.
You know. Mm-hmm. But back then, to get it made, you really did have to have, you know, be actors that people knew or people who used to do sitcoms and now are trying to break into other things. And it used to be on, pick your network, NBC on Sunday night so that people would tune in sometimes for weeks at a time.
But Richard Chamberlain coming off of like Shogun in the early right. 80s, this would have been a big deal for him casting in this. So strange it didn't get much traction. Or maybe it did and I don't remember.
I mean, the thing he had done right before this was that Alan Quatermain in the Lost City of Gold movie. I'm just checking him up here, which is one of those, you know, King Solomon's Mind, like he, you know, Indiana Jones-esque action film. So he was the guy. I mean, it makes sense. But anyway, Mr. Byrne, do you want to try to give us a plot synopsis to this?
Oh, or? No, I'm not going to go there. I'll let Mike, who has deeper experience.
I've got the one who takes notes.
I've got something written down.
I have amnesia. Maybe something will trigger as he's talking and I'll remember.
Yeah, I do actually. I think before getting into the plot, I think I've actually seen the made-for-TV movie.
Did you really?
Yeah, so thinking back, I remember my grandfather actually was the one that kind of got me interested in thrillers. He loved Tom Clancy. He loved Robert Ludlum. He loved Brad Thor. And so those were always on the coffee table. Those were the books that he loved to read. So I remember I saw the movie first, and then I was talking with my grandfather, and it might have even been his copy of the book that I ended up picking up, and I ended up reading through the Bourne Identity, and then complaining to my grandfather about halfway through, being like, this is nothing like the movie. This has nothing to do with any of the plot or the story that I thought that I was going to be seeing. And then my grandfather said, yeah, but that's the movie. It doesn't follow along with the book, but I do have the movie that does follow along with the book. So I don't know where it is that he retrieved it from, but he ended up having a copy of of the old Bourne Identity movie that does indeed follow the plot of the book. So I can remember sitting in the living room and watching it with my grandfather. So maybe there's some sentimentality behind it. And that's probably part of the reason why I'm so fond of it as well. But anyways, that's a little bit of a personal tangent for the made-for-TV movie. But anyway, so the Bourne Identity, it does start the exact same way in the movie and in the book, which is with a man who has been shot and found in the Mediterranean Sea who has amnesia. He's kind of like fished out of the water by these fishermen. And there's one, he's kind of like brought into the harbor, brought into the town. And there's a doctor there that's working on him. And there's a doctor, he's both kind of trying to help him figure out who he is and where it is that he comes from, as well as treating him. And it becomes very clear that this man has amnesia. And the only other real piece of evidence as to this person's identity is a bank account that is that has been surgically implanted into this man's hip. We learn later on that it was by Bourne's request that it be put into his hip. But at the time, certainly we don't know that. All we have is this bank account in Zurich, and so we have kind of like the start of that of trying to figure out who Jason or who this mysterious man is. He's nursed back to health by this morally gray doctor. I'm blanking on the name of the doctor that had nursed him back to health. But in any event, he kind of like gives him a false passport to try and kind of help this guy back onto his feet to figure out who he is. And it launches who we later figure out is Bourne on this track to try and figure out who he is. So he ends up going to the bank in Zurich that he has this account with. It's there in the he's greeted with the name of Jason Bourne. And so we start to kind of piece together a little bit about this person's name.
He's recognized at the hotel, right?
Yes. Before making his way to the bank, he's recognized. I would imagine by the concierge, or the person at the front desk. And so it's at that time that he knows his name. Some of the passages that I did find interesting were kind of when you get into the mindset of the character who just takes the pen in his hand and starts to write as fluidly as he can the signature of Jason Bourne, and then lo and behold, there it is right in front of him. And so we learn at the bank that his name that the name that he's going by is indeed Jason Bourne. There's an affiliation with the Treadstone Company, Treadstone 71, which is just a mysterious kind of name on the horizon that we don't until much, much, much later on in the story in our 600-page book figure out what that Treadstone means for our character. And there's 7.5 million Swiss francs, which I think at the time was equivalent to 5 million US dollars that's in this account. Of course, our character with amnesia, this man with amnesia, is stunned to figure out what this $5 million is and where it is that he has no idea where it is that it comes from. But we're off and running trying to figure out kind of what the identity of this character is. So we can kind of pause there. And if there's anything that you guys want to add or anything else that that you guys think that I might have missed.
No, it's painfully slow to find out his name.
Yeah.
It's about 200 pages.
It's just the patient,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, the patient. Then it's Jay Bourne, and he goes, my first name is Jason. And there's, like, yeah. There's a lot of realization here. He eventually starts using the Force and just says, well, if this is the way I'm going, I guess this is my right decision. Mm-hmm. And he's being called to various places. Also, just to say, and I know we'll get into this throughout, I think it's interesting about how this kind of affected other novels and other mm-hmm. stories. And you kind of see this a lot after this. We'll get there. I know I've been convinced that 9/11 had ruined film for about 15 years because everything becomes more intense, much more, we don't actually know anything. And I'm a big fan of the big, stupid 80s action movies mm-hmm. and late 90s action movies. And that kind of ruined this. And so it's interesting to see the difference between this and the book or mm-hmm. this and the movie or however you want to put it. But the idea here, even in this, you can see it inspired some of like the Daniel Craig James Bond movies mm-hmm. about this idea that he's a man who is out and he has to get back in and the world is against him and he's a man apart, a man on his own, except yeah. for the woman that he picks up along the way that we'll talk about in a moment. Mm-hmm. But they said, according to Publishers Weekly, which, you know, I read every week. This is the second best spy novel of all time after the John le Carré, The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, oh. The Day of the Jackal, The Spy Who Loved Me, and a book by Norman Mailer, appropriately for Norman Mailer, called The Harlot's Ghost, which is a very Norman Mailer title.
I knew the title. I didn't know that was a spy thriller. Huh.
But yeah, I can see how this affected stuff. It's always mm-hmm. interesting to read or watch something that clearly affected the way an entire genre mm-hmm. comes together. And I see notes of this and even something like Die Hard, where he's a man outside of himself. He has to figure it out. Like, this is at the beginning of the 80s. Most of the big 80s action movies is about a, something much bigger world, and this one lone man on his own who happens to be American can somehow figure his way through an incredibly complex scenario.
Yeah, I'm glad you, I was going to say that. It's very American, and they have this singular male who's going to be the hero and figure it all out.
Yeah. Right. Oh. As opposed to, say, Tom Clancy, where it might be Jack Ryan, but it's submarines filled with people and this entire situation that he might be able to defuse, but he's clearly barely in charge over anyone else.
Yeah.
You know. And so I find that part very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that there's kind of a similarity there of almost like a little bit of reluctance, right? That both in with Jason Bourne and then in even just thinking about Jack Ryan, there's almost like this imperfect hero, certainly in the case of Jason Bourne, I think also very much certainly in the case of the Jack Ryan character as well, where it's like he's heroic. He has this military background. There's this notion of even right from the very start of the story, kind of like pulling himself up by the bootstraps. And I'm glad that you guys brought up that kind of like Americanized side of it, because I think that the very American hero is, especially in the 1980s, is certainly prevalent in this novel and in a lot of those thriller movies and a lot of those thriller books that I love as well.
Yeah, he's a spy with a heart of gold, right? Yeah. So even as he's realizing
he didn't used to be, Mike. Right, he didn't used to have a heart of gold.
Even though that's a little murky because he realizes he's great at killing people, but he's not as big of a killer as he thought he was initially. And so that's sort of like,
good, right?
Yeah, like, oh, I'm a good guy, actually. Yeah. Yes, even though I'm murdering people professionally.
And just to put it into a historical context a little bit, by, you know, the 70s, we didn't feel like we were behind the Cold War, but, you know, after years of, you know, realpolitik, it had kind of decelerated, and we were more afraid of people around the world. The Latin American revolutions, the Iranians, you know, this is the year, I'm sure he was writing it through the, you know, at this point he's pumping out almost a novel a year, but, you know, he was probably thinking about it during most of the Carter years. And the big threat at the time was a guy in 1975 who makes his name known as Carlos the Jackal, who is, you know, he probably started out as a, you know, a communist, Marxist-Leninist terrorist in Latin America, but soon is around the world killing people. And he's not caught until 1994, and he's been in jail ever since. Mm-hmm. But this idea, like, that there's this lone evil guy, there's even a movie called The Jackal starring, is it Bruce Willis?
Yeah, I know it's a Frederick Forsyth book originally, Day of the Jackal, right.
And it's like, it's such a, to have a real life, something so dramatic going on, it's fascinating.
You know? And Nick, you're the historian, but I think it's obvious too that you get into this, there's some hangover from Vietnam in our hero's backstory, mm-hmm. which was certainly in the, you know, zeitgeist in the late 70s, 80s, when he's, early 80s when he's writing this.
What city, is it Saigon they keep throwing it around? Like, what happened in Saigon?
Yeah.
Like, it's just,
yeah.
And he doesn't remember, so we don't ever have to get into that, which is very convenient.
But it was
to the
bad,
plot.
And it was murky. Which is,
oh, God, he was Vietnam. Someone else that, like, Colin Powell was trying to defend, like, My Lai or whatever. It's just, there's something horrible that went down. But yeah, so after, like, the whole opening bit of this is really, it is a scene from As the World Turns. Like, he wakes up, he doesn't know, there's a drunk doctor looking over him.
Yeah,
he's like, you need to get a job because I'm a drunk. And he goes, well, why aren't you a doctor in a bigger town? Because I'm a drunk. which is such a great, like, all right, moving on. And then he gets aboard a ship, beats up everyone on the ship, and that's the end of Jason Bourne's boat adventure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, and I know that we've talked about this briefly already, but you're piecing the story together as Bourne is piecing it together, and while that can be frustrating at times, I think that it adds to kind of some of the storytelling that you're kind of just thrust into these, to use the word that we've thrown around a couple of times, these like very murky waters. You're figuring it out and you're piecing together this world as Bourne is piecing together the world. So kind of continuing along after the discovery of at least the name of Jason Bourne and then the discovery of this money as well. Jason or Bourne sends a whole bunch of money back. I think it was at this time that he sends as like a thank you gift back to the doctor who had nursed him back to health. And that in the States is kind of like their first indication that, and we'll get into this later on, but it's the first indication that perhaps Bourne has turned. And so there's some almost like mistaken identity there to play off of that word identity that ends up coming as a result of sending a great deal of this money to that doctor that had helped nurse him back to health. But he ends up leaving the bank, and as he's doing so, he's attacked by these men. And throughout the story, it's unclear who the men are. And as we piece together more and more and more of the story, we learn that these are Carlos's men that attack him as he's leaving the bank. He ends up taking Marie hostage. This is the Marie that Mike was referring to earlier on. And this starts off into one of the most forced enemies to lovers relationships in any of the literature that I can think of. But he kind of like takes Marie hostage as a way of escaping from this hotel. Now, Marie is an economist from Canada, and she's there at like, and this is the kind of like the little softball that's thrown up here with the Marxist. I think it was like a Marxist presentation that she's there to hear through. So it's a little bit of kind of like a head nod there to some of that ideology. But she, in the midst of this, kind of like takes Marie hostage as he's trying to escape from the hotel. You can see why this is just made to be put into a movie. And then it's at this time that we're still trying to figure out, or Bourne is trying to figure out still more about who he is. He goes and sees a restaurant owner at this like triangular. He's got this image in his mind of these triangles that just leads him to this restaurant that he needs to go and talk to the owner of. And we get a little bit more of kind of like the backstory there. And then Marie is attacked, or Bourne and Marie are attacked by Carlos's men. It's at that time that Bourne saves Marie from Carlos's men, nearly dies in the process. And that's when Marie has her turn of heart. She despises Bourne. Of course, it's the person who's taken her hostage, and now all of a sudden we have the change of heart. He rescues Marie, and now Marie is in love, almost with the flip of a switch, with her former prison guard, captive, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's where I had to put the book down. Yeah. And it's like, come on, really? And like here, he's using her as a human shield. She's crying and all this. And he does save her from being raped. We'll give him that credit. And then she falls in love with him. Yeah. And it's like, you mentioned soap opera. It's a straight up a soap opera plot. Well,
and it would have been so easy to just be like, because there's this weird thread that she thinks she can protect him and find out who the company is. That's it. You don't need to have a romantic entanglement. Like, she realizes that there's something there. That's all you need.
Yeah.
It does get very strange.
So I found Marie very off-putting. I mean, not she's chauvinistic, strange, but just like it's shoved in there. Like, it's sort of, did you guys feel that way?
I felt like it was out of place.
Yeah.
It was, to me, I haven't read the earlier books, but to me, it was a note that, you know, you don't have very strong female
characters. There's no
women
in this novel, right?
So he added one that was a PhD and worked for the Canadian government, right. But that was it. Otherwise, she's just another like olive oil. She's always in distress.
Yeah.
I should also just mention that, you know, Dr. Jim Beam at the beginning is completely gone from the story. Like, it's like the beginning of like Legend of Zelda or something. It's dangerous out here. Take this gun. And then he's gone.
Dr. Jim Beam.
But, like, that's who he is.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You'd think that, like, because they set up, oh, he gives all this money, maybe at the end he has to go back and protect the doctor because now he's made the doctor a target.
Yeah.
Didn't matter.
And then backstory stuff, the doctor figures out, like, this is, like, the perfect, you know, his eyes are gray, blue, and then they're green sometimes. And his face has been modified to be, like, absolutely bland and blend in with the crowd. And so the doctor has all these insights, right? And sort of like a very perceptive character, and then it's just gone, right?
Yeah.
Maybe it comes back in another series. I don't know. Does he survive this? Does Treadstone hunt him down? I actually don't remember.
I don't know. I mean, there's two more novels.
You figure, like, so many people die around Bourne that maybe they would have gone to him. But
yeah, it's so funny that, like, and then along the way, they drop. Once he's kicked off the boat, he goes to Zurich, which is the farthest you can be from an ocean possible. And he ends up at this this is where we have the banking scenario. Now, we should just talk about the bank for a second because it's actually incredibly important later on. He, you know, they recognize the eyes. They do all the things. They do. It's just Magic MacGuffin stuff. But he goes back into the room with this banker. And the banker says, Mr. Bourne, you have this much money. How do you want to deal with it? He pulls it all out. And by doing so, he triggers the events of the entire rest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he finds out that the money comes from a firm called Treadstone 71, mm-hmm. which doesn't really exist, kind of exists. We'll figure it out later on. It's a front. It's a CIA front. And you can tell this is something that couldn't come out any other time, because this is after a bunch of the CIA stuff had started to come out, that they had secret bases, that there was this interference throughout the Eisenhower administration. And so they kind of redoubled the secrecy where, yes, the company is involved, but also like very few senators know what's even going on. The president only knows if he asks about it, which again, is Jimmy Carter. So he's like, hometown boy's trying to do something good here.
Yeah, and I think that in one way, this novel kind of has at its forefront, in my opinion, maybe too many adversaries and too many unclear adversaries. Like at this point, in terms of the plot that we've gone through so far, Carlos hasn't even come up. The Jackal hasn't even come up. We've seen like his men, but we haven't even had the first instance yet in the confessional booth at the church. Carlos isn't even a name that we've discovered in our story. And Treadstone, we don't know if they're good or bad. So it's almost as though there are all of this world is from like three or four different angles, from the Treadstone angle, from the like local police angle, from the Carlos angle. It's like this entire world is coming collapsing down on Bourne, and it's hard to decipher at certain points. I mean, we don't even know about Carlos yet, and we're already a third of the way through the book, right? So I think that in some ways it kind of suffers from having perhaps like too many adversaries and too many kind of like antagonists that are pushing back against Bourne.
I don't even know if he's been called Cain yet.
Like, no, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Right? Like, right. For a while, they're trying to figure out if he's the assassin known as Cain who's trying to upend Carlos. And we do get around the bank a bunch of nemesis. That when they're described, I just think of the Nazis from Raiders of the Lost Ark, mm-hmm. because it's guys in trench coats and hats and very pale. Like, they all have these distinctive, like, physical characteristics that Bourne can be like, oh, no, it's the pale guy. And you're just like, all right, we're here. We're in it. Yeah. But this leads us to the fancy hotel because he's running from the people. He's hiding. They chase him into the conference center at the basement of this luxury hotel. Mm-hmm. And then he uses her as a human shield to go to this fat, blustery guy's restaurant.
The Triangle Restaurant. I can't remember the name. Yeah,
because that's what he did. He just asked the taxi driver or the concierge, the guy, the valet. It's the valet. He goes, I'm about to steal a car. Triangle. What's a nice restaurant? Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of like at this point where there's like, I think that we needed, because the novel is 600 pages, I think we needed like four or five fewer like missions that Marie and Jason essentially go on. We've got like the phone call that they end up going through for the French bank that they try and kind of like get to the bottom of. We've got like the department store, like the clothing store that leads us to another character and a little bit more information there. And it's at this point where they go into the newspaper clippings because Bourne is trying to prove to himself that he couldn't be this great killer. He couldn't be Carlos because he thinks that he is Carlos at first. And then he hears that the killing was taking place when he couldn't possibly have been there. So we know that he's not Carlos, but it's at that time that Marie and Bourne encounter this older newspaper, and Bourne plays like the mysterious game that he has from his background, and he doesn't know where it is that it's coming from, but he has Marie read through the article that he hasn't read through yet, and then not unlike a student who's trying to prepare him or herself for a quiz or a test, has Marie kind of like almost quiz him on what it is that he's being able to come up with without having read the article. So he's kind of trying to summarize and put pieces together of the story. And it's then that we figure out that we've got this Carlos, and that's where the name Cain comes from, is with this newspaper article that has been written about this mysterious Cain. So now Bourne is worried that, okay, well, I'm not Carlos, but maybe I am this Cain killer. And it's finally at this point point. We're now probably a little bit more than halfway through the novel, where finally we flash to the States. I can't remember if it's in New York or if it's in Washington at like Langley or at the Pentagon or something like that. But we have like now that this is when Nick, we have the room full of the old war generals with their cigars, and they're talking about this the Medusa project, and we're talking about, we finally get some of the answers that then we start to kind of like sprinkle in as the story continues along, right? So we kind of like flash back into the States. It's where we get the Kane character, who is taking credit for, he's an assassin, and he's taking credit for all of these kills throughout the world to become a rival assassin to this Carlos assassin, and so we get kind of like into the depths of where it is that this Kane murderer assassin comes from, and it's essentially been orchestrated by the U.S. government in order to create an adversary, in order to create a rival assassin for this Carlos, in order to bring Carlos out, to kind of like bait Carlos out, in order for Bourne, who has taken on the identity of this Kane, to root out, hunt, and essentially kill this Carlos assassin. And so we get all of this through kind of like this conversation of four or five different generals in the United States who are watching their Kane operation totally go down the drain because of the fact that Bourne is, they think, turned. So we get a little bit of kind of like the backstory there. So we can kind of like hit pause on everything that's been thrown at our story at that point.
What can I add to that? Other than, yeah, just the plot thickens, yeah. Essentially.
We should add that like there's a lot of them going to libraries around here, yeah, where he's trying to figure out who he could potentially be. This is when they revisit the assassination of an ambassador,
yep,
which at first people thought was Carlos, but then turns out to be Kane, and mm-hmm, now we don't know what to believe. And around here is where the Treadstone building in Washington is also blown, mm-hmm, up. Well, blown up. People,
yeah,
are killed.
Right. Yeah. And it's framed on Bourne. So right, that's Carlos's men who we're introduced to Carlos. He's got this facade of being a priest who's in I can't remember where what the country is that the
Paris.
In Paris. France. Yeah.
So we have the all of Carlos's men who come to the confessional, and they've got it's so 80s like spy. We've got like the code words that they need to say so that they know that this isn't somebody who actually was coming in to like go to the Sacrament of Reconciliation. We actually have somebody who's trying to communicate with the assassin Carlos behind this veil of figuratively and literally of this confessional booth. So the Carlos sends his men to essentially destroy and kill people in Treadstone and frame it on Bourne. And that's exactly what they end up doing. And it's at this point that I think it's Conlin is the one of the survivors from the attack, or he wasn't, mm-hmm, there in the building when Treadstone was attacked. And so Conlin goes to try to root out Bourne, to try and find, and I think even like kill Bourne, to, because he thinks he's so convinced that he has indeed turned from their original plans. And Conlin, it's at this point that he kind of like meets with Bourne in a graveyard, yep, and tries to kind of like figure out what it is that's going on with Bourne. Conlin, I don't think, is ever convinced that Bourne hasn't been turned. And so it's yet another point where Bourne is attacked by this time the Treadstone men in the graveyard. No, it's both. I think that Carlos's men and Treadstone that are there to kind of root out Bourne, and it's where Bourne finally gets a little bit of information about realizing that he's been framed for this attack on Treadstone that he didn't even know had taken place. So we get kind of like we're leading up to what I would call like the end game here with the destruction of the Treadstone front, and as well as a little bit more about this Carlos character.
Well, and I'll just throw this in here. This whole book, this movement, is where I really get the whiff of the blockbuster novel.
Yeah.
If I may, like, because, you know, for those of you who don't know, the term blockbuster comes from the movie Jaws, which was the biggest movie of all time. Mm-hmm. Then we have Star Wars, then we have Indiana Jones. Like, the idea that the whole world will stop and watch this one thing.
Yeah.
And by the 80s, this is also a concept in novels, right? This is where we get the rise of Tom Clancy and obviously here Robert Ludlum and Stephen King and then eventually Michael Crichton, John Grisham. And everyone read these books.
Right.
This is where editing apparently just goes away. Like Stephen King can write 800 pages easy.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. This is him saying like, okay, so this is going to be the next book that's going to spawn 3 movies, 4 sequels, and just go, right? And because of that, they just let him go. And these all feel like they could be movie scenes.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, that's why you create someone like a Jack Ryan character. That's why you create an Ian Malcolm or whoever. Like in here, Jason Bourne.
Because
you can have 6 of these movies. They all have big cinematic moments.
Yeah.
And it just goes. And, you know, credit to credit's due. This book now is 43 years old and it's not just because of Paul Greengrass. There's still some prescience to it. It's clearly made an impact.
Yeah.
There's clearly a generation of young producers and directors who read this and they wanted to do it. Like the scene in the graveyard reminds me of GoldenEye where he meets Trevelyan in the Leninist graveyard, right? Like, and you have this like, and there's like, and even that kind of sort of feels like when Woodward and Bernstein are meeting Deep Throat in the parking deck, right? Yeah. Like, it's aware of what's happening around him. He's making callbacks, but also creating a whole genre in and of himself.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I think you hit the nail right on the head there, Nick, in talking about kind of like this. It's so, I think, representative of this genre, right? Just thinking about The Fugitive, thinking about U.S. Marshals, thinking about Enemy of the State. These are all movies that are like so many of the scenes in these movies that I love are so reminiscent of these scenes that I'm then reading through or rereading through in this book. And they're really made for TV, which and I think that there's something to that, right? I think that it's not just the action. I think that it's the kind of like the character that's being put into this situation, and it's not just like a Western, like spaghetti Western or like a shoot 'em up type of a scene. There's a lot that's on the line, right? Whether it's unraveling this conspiracy, whether it's finding the character's identity, whether it's global assassinations that are taking place. There's the magnitude is bigger than what our character is in the midst of, and yet the world that they're interacting with, this world that they're trying to unravel and figure out the puzzle pieces of, it really is, it's so much bigger than what the character is doing in that very moment. And so that's part of what I love about the thriller genre, is that there's so much more and so much bigger that's going on, right?
Well, and listen to our previous episode on Jurassic Park, science was developing in a way that it could be abused, right? Like the idea of the cloning technology was around in the late 80s when they were writing this. This does that very well with the kind of American awareness of Vietnam. Well, we don't want to remember Vietnam. Vietnam is difficult. Mm-hmm. We don't want to talk about it. But can we come out of it and be a better nation because of it? Yes, we can learn from Vietnam and still save the world, which is Jason Bourne in a nutshell, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's coming out against a group that's effectively the CIA... Americans did not like the CIA at the time.
And it's just one of the layers, right? It's just that one treadstone layer is woven in with the Carlos layer, is woven in with this journey to figure out who the character is. And I think that it takes 600 pages to do so, but it all does end up coming together in I think a satisfying way. But anyway, so we kind of make our way from getting this attack on Treadstone and Conlan's interaction with Bourne in the graveyard, where I think one of the people who was killed, and it's alluded to very briefly, but I think one of the characters that was killed in the Treadstone attack was David Webb's brother. And so it's the first mention that we get of that name, David Webb. And so we get yet another piece to kind of the Jason Bourne identity puzzle. But we go from there into kind of what I said before, the end game of trying to get Carlos to come out. So Bourne kind of baits Carlos out by going to General Viller, whose wife was a mole in Carlos's network. And in kind of trying to figure out what's going on with General Viller's wife, who was certainly very much involved in Carlos's network, ends up explaining to General Viller his wife's role in the network, including but not limited to the death of his son that was wrapped up in this as well. And so General Viller kills his wife, and it's at that point that Bourne, seeing an opportunity, takes credit for the death of General Viller's wife in order to try to like double cross Carlos into coming out, and it's successful.
Right.
Carlos, of course, wants to kill the person that he thinks is Kane, and so Kane, not Bourne, but Kane takes credit for the death of General Viller's wife, and Bourne / Kane gives Carlos exactly what it is that he wants, which is an opportunity to kill Bourne / Kane on the very day that Bourne had killed the actual Jason Bourne, of whom he took his name. So we know that there's at this point the Bourne, we know this from the statesmen who are back in the States, Bourne had killed the actual Jason Bourne in order to assume his identity. And now Bourne is giving Carlos exactly what it is that he wants, an opportunity to exterminate and kill Kane at the exact day that Kane had, or really that Bourne had been killed before. So we have this a letter that's written to Carlos from Kane to try and get Carlos to come out, and it all comes to a front in New York, which is where Carlos and Bourne have their confrontation. It's in the Treadstone office where Carlos, along with his other men, are end up attacking Bourne, and then right at that moment where you think that Carlos is going to kill Bourne or vice versa, the Treadstone agents come, and Carlos, in order to try and keep his identity a secret, ends up fleeing before either he has an opportunity to kill Bourne or Bourne has an opportunity to kill him. So it certainly seems like our hero has his back up against the wall, and it's at that moment where the gunfire stops and Carlos ends up escaping. So we get kind of like the climactic moment where you get Bourne and Carlos, they're in the room, they're hiding behind the different pieces of furniture that have been upturned, and it's then that the gunfire stops and Carlos, in order to keep his anonymity, ends up fleeing.
Yeah.
So we end up getting what is one of the longest epilogues that I think I've ever read in kind of like the aftermath here, because what they end up doing is they use Marie as kind of like the audience surrogate, right? So
right.
So we end up telling through Marie, kind of like piecing together, almost like in case you were in the bathroom, in case you missed it, here's everything that had been going on. We get the story of Bourne's past, the Medusa operation. We learn that Bourne was in a special forces unit in Vietnam, that his wife and two children were killed, that the original Jason Bourne had been a double agent that then Bourne ends up killing and taking on his identity. We hear all of this like from the doctor's perspective, telling Marie what it is all that had happened in the aftermath of that New York attack on the Treadstone company. And then it ends with the whole story ends with Bourne being the only person who's ever seen Carlos's face, but his memory is not strong enough for him to be able to actually identify who Carlos is. And so the whole story kind of comes to a conclusion with the name David Webb, which again had been alluded to only very briefly before, but we get the suggestion that this David Webb character was the one who originally had killed Bourne and then taken his identity. And so the story ends with this name David coming back up to the surface. Certainly leaving room for a sequel, right? I mean, it's kind of just like teeing up the fact that this is an unfinished story that needs another 2, 3, 4, 5 movies and books in order to complete the story.
And yeah, and you know, I can imagine when it came out, as people were reading it over the course of just days and days, because it's 600 pages, them wanting to talk about it. Because, you know, when Mike here is simplifying the plot, it's a complex narrative. You know, they're getting scraps of information. They're slowly piecing it together. And so that's where the thriller part comes in.
Yeah.
And, you know, the scene where the Carlos's people comes in, kills everyone at Treadstone 71 is dramatic. The part where the survivor is you know, might kill Jason, that's dramatic.
Yeah.
And then we cut back to members of the CIA and the president's whatever talking about what should be done. That's dramatic. Like, yeah. Because we at this point like Jason, kind of. And we think he's going to try to save the day. And we know Carlos exists, mm-hmm. but no one else does.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and that's what makes this dramatic. And so just know that because he has, you know, shared the whole plot does not tell you the actual book, you know, in a lot of ways.
And that's why it's part of the reason why, to be a little bit critical of it, I think that it doesn't necessarily need to be quite that long, because it's kind of a lot of the same thing coming up again and again and again. It's this theme of identity and unknown identity, first of Jason Bourne, then of Kane, then of Carlos. Then at the end of the story, we end with this moment of unknown identity of David Webb. But throughout the entire story, each of the moments when Bourne is up against any sort of physical altercation, whether it's with a hand-to-hand combat with a knife or in a gunfire or whatever it happens to be, you don't know who what the identity is of the people that are Jason Bourne's adversary. So it's this constant story, and it keeps looping back around again and again and again of these different cases and instances of unknown identity. And I don't think that we needed all 35 of them. I think that we could have truncated that a little bit and made the story a little bit longer. Now, again, I loved the story. Yeah. And I loved it even more in my reread of it than I did with my original one. I think throughout the entire story, my first time reading through, I kept waiting for the plot of the movie to surface, and it never came. Around when Bourne was in the clothing store in the department store, I was like, wait a minute, this is definitely not the plot of the movie that that I'm used to seeing. But I think that notion of that keep coming, that continually keeping coming back to that unknown identity, I think is kind of like a recurring element that continues through the story. And then it does that with kind of like with verbal cues as well. It's not until we hear Bourne kind of like thinking about this notion of a chameleon, and then all of a sudden this identity of a chameleon being able to shift in and out of his environment keeps coming back again and again. The verbal cue of Delta is for Charlie, Charlie is for Kane, that keeps coming back. It's almost like it's almost like you're in the head of this person who has amnesia, who's trying to kind of like trigger, and he only has these certain touch points that he keeps coming back to and thinking about again and again and again. And then kind of the trope of like the double cross, where it's not until we hear the statesman talking and using the phrase about how, like, it's something, and I'm going to paraphrase here, like, in order to cross an agent, it needs to be simple. In order to double cross an agent, it needs to be even simpler. Right. And then that's something that Bourne starts using in his own line of thinking only after it's been introduced. So it's almost like once you learn something, it becomes one of those touch points that keeps coming back again and again, kind of like that identity that I was talking about before. But it's part of what it is that I think is so interesting about the story, because the dramatic irony that you're getting only happens about halfway through the story. Right. You're thrown into the story, and it's only you as the reader only know more than Jason Bourne once you encounter that statesman conversation with their cigars back in the States, and that only happens about two-thirds of the way through the story.
Right.
So you only know more than the character for the last third of the novel, and so I think that it's a story that could have relied so much more on that, and I'm glad they didn't. But the both the movie and the novel, I think, don't rely on dramatic irony. That really it's only the last third where you know any more information than Bourne does. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I think I like the story more because of that. I think I like the story more because of the fact that I'm learning along the same pace that Bourne is.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'll stop here. Nice. 1, 2, 3. So we're just about out of time. You're on mic. I can hear you.
Okay.
Although you might need to aim the microphone towards your actual face.
How's that?
That's good. So we're just about out of time. So we should go around the table and kind of give our final thoughts before we don't do it. So I'll start with you, Mr. Carroll. What did you think of the book overall?
Yeah, so I loved it. I loved it. I really, for everything from the language to the storytelling aspects of it to the amnesia, to some of those kind of like language tropes that keep coming back. I was fascinated by it. I always knew that I would be, but it was a story that I think you kind of develop alongside Bourne, and you learn the backstory alongside Bourne, and it's always been something that's really fascinated me. I've always loved everything from the Tom Clancy novels to movies like The Fugitive and U.S. Marshals, even season 3 of Jack Ryan, where you have the protagonist that's kind of like on the run and needing to kind of put the puzzle together as he's going. And that's always been one of my favorite kind of tropes in literature and in movies. And I think that the Bourne identity just does so much that makes thrillers such an awesome genre. I think the Bourne identity just does it all so well. So I really loved it upon the reread.
Yeah, I'll agree. I liked it. And I like what you said there about sort of evolving with Bourne as it goes, as he figures it out. Because there's definitely some cognitive dissonance as you go. And you're just like, what is this? And do you stick with it or not? I will say, as I said earlier, I found the love interest like stretching any credulity, just ridiculous. So I wonder why that's even there. But you get into the novel, it's definitely a plot turner and a page turner that you want to keep going, and it just sort of carries you along with the momentum. So it's the perfect sort of summer read. I don't know that I could teach it. It might be a nice optional book for kids that are, you know, avid readers or like spies and thrillers like that. But yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah, just for me, for a movie that, of course, has been made into a very successful film franchise, a book has been turned into a film franchise, it does all the things right to tell a story, right? Like, when it slows down, it doesn't feel exposition heavy most of the time. There's a few times, but most of the time, I like that there's not like an exposition dump at the beginning. Mm-hmm. We kind of build the story along with Bourne, right?
Yeah.
Like there's not like your stereotypical Bond scene where he sits down with M and gets the whole plot in one go.
Yeah.
And they tell it through, you know, smoky back rooms with senators and cigars. And
yeah.
I do kind of like that old feel to it. But, you know, considering I've only read one or two other Ludlums, I understand why he was considered a master of the genre, and I'd put this up with a Le Carre book. And
oh,
yeah,
I would go there. The prose is sometimes just so leaden, and just like, and the dialogue, and just like Le Carre is just like a master of like the sparsity, like Hemingway-esque, and like he says so much with so little. This is 600 pages.
Definitely
could use some editing and cutting down.
Yeah. I'll have a note on that too, Mike. I as much as I did like and. Well, actually, I'll take a step back. I do kind of like some of the language. It's certainly far from Hemingway-esque.
Very pulpy.
But I don't mind that. I kind of in the midst of. I mean, I've seen so many more thriller movies than I've read thriller books, and I think for that reason, I kind of like a little bit of the literary being kind of tossed in there. And I didn't mind some of the more loquacious passages and some of the exposition that you guys are talking about, but the. I think for me, it doesn't need to be 600 pages, right? I think that you enter into the story and it's kind of in medias res for what's going on in terms of the larger plot, but you're also being thrown into it right at the start of what Bourne understands. So it's kind of this interesting storytelling where you're right in the middle of things, you're right in the thick of things, but it's also at the same time right at the start of where this character's identity is really beginning. And so from a storytelling aspect of it, I think that there are things that I'm fascinated by that I really like, but at the same time, it does not need to be as long as it was. I remembered certain aspects and certain passages when I was rereading it, but I did not remember it being quite that long. And I think that you kind of come in and out and are misled and re-led in a couple of different directions that it doesn't need to be quite as intricately large of a tapestry, to follow my mixed metaphors now. But I do think that it just certainly doesn't need to be as long as it is. And it's very non-Hemingway-esque in that sense, which I didn't mind.
Next month we'll read Dashiell Hammett. There's like 50 pages.
Sure.
It's done. Hammett. But yeah, so thanks for listening. Thanks for doing what you do to make us successful. Thanks for sharing us. If you're interested in whether or not Mike Carroll is lying to you, you can actually now hear some of his short stories if you follow this and follow his Insta, of course. And next episode, we'll be covering another movie that was made into a blockbuster, but this one has even less to do with the book. We'll be talking Max Brooks's World War Z. So thanks.
Thanks.
Yep.
Required Reading is a product of Maris Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks.